From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, Mayor Tom Barrett joins us to talk about the protests, the ongoing pandemic, and the future of the DNC here in Milwaukee.
Communities around this nation are under incredible duress. And I still believe that this is an opportunity for our city to showcase how you come out of a pandemic, how a community deals with police-community relations, how we deal with the economic downturn.
Plus, our Listen MKE series highlights the goals of protesters in Milwaukee and information for those who want to get involved.
We have been asking for these types of things for years and years and years. People have now taken the streets for, I think it's going on 11 or 12 days. The time is now for people to respond.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. We're only halfway into 2020, and already our community has faced so many surprising and extraordinary challenges. A global pandemic has shut down businesses, kept our communities in isolation, and brought our economy to a screeching halt. Over the past couple weeks, after some high-profile incidents of police brutality, Milwaukeeans and Americans around the country took to the streets, demanding justice, reform, and accountability. And through all of this, we've been looking to our leaders for guidance, many of us with hopeful and critical eyes. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has been both criticized and praised for his actions during this pandemic and the mounting protests. He joins me now to talk about some of those issues facing our city. Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
I'm happy to be with you.
So as you know, protests have erupted in a lot of different communities throughout the Milwaukee area, decrying police brutality. You actually marched alongside some of these protesters. What led to that decision?
Well, I think that what we're seeing right now is a fundamental shift in our society as to how we view the relationship between the community and our police departments. And I think it's very, very important to listen to people. And part of what I wanted to do was listen to people, listen to young people, see what their concerns are, see what we can do as a city to make the reforms that are necessary to move us forward. And I say that knowing full well that a lot of what needs to be done is out of the direct control of the city, that there is the state that obviously comes into play. There are union contracts. There are court decisions. But clearly, the city has a very, very important role to play to improve police-community relations. And I want to be part of that, and I will be part of that.
Well, and that gets to a question that I have. You know, a lot of people have credited the death of George Floyd for sparking these protests, but Milwaukee has its own history of police brutality. And we see this pretty typical cycle. People protest, the city says it's going to change, and then nothing really feels like it changes, and people go out and protest once again. Why should we expect this moment to be different?
I think we should not only expect this moment to be different, I think we should demand that this moment is different. But I think what many people don't recognize, and I'll just talk about a couple of things that we have done here locally to try to deal with these issues. And I go back to the Frank Jude case, which occurred shortly after I became the mayor of the city of Milwaukee. And at that time, after I started seeing the reports, the question I asked was, how did this guy ever end up, when I say this guy, the key defendant in that case, how did he ever end up on the police department? And I was given the explanation. And I said, look, we have to have psychological tests for people before they become members of this department. That is something that's very, very important. So under my watch, the police department now, for applicants for the police department, all undergo psychological testing to make sure that they're suited. This is a difficult job, and it's a very important job. It's a very challenging job. It's not a job for everybody. And so I felt it was very, very important for us to have that psychological testing in place. So that's one significant change that has happened. Several years later, I worked with the Fire and Police Commission and the then police chief, and we've instituted the practice now for cameras. And you've seen around the nation the challenges that we have had with the body cameras. But I'm a firm believer that the body cameras are there to help the public, but also to help the police officers. That because you're going to have a recorded history, if you will, of what transpired, it helps both parties, and it particularly helps good people. When I say good people, I mean the people from the community who have done nothing wrong and the police officers who have done nothing wrong. If someone has violated the law, that's going to show up on the video. If the police officer violates the law, that's going to show up on the video. So I think that that's another significant change. A third change that came about, and this happened after the shooting at for Dr. Hamilton in Red Arrow Park, we instituted, with the help of the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, better de-escalation training and more training actually for more mental health type procedures that officers could follow. And the debate at that time was whether only officers who wanted to have this training should have it, or whether all officers should have it. And I felt that all officers should have it, because you don't know who's going to be interacting with the public. So those are just three examples of reforms that are being discussed in other parts of the country that are already here. Now, having said all that, I know we have, as a police department, a long way to go. And we have seen incidents, oftentimes incidents involving African-American men, where there is an overreaction. And I think that we have to have more training. This is one of the reasons that I feel so passionately about having the members of our police department and our fire department be members of our community. I want them to be members of our community, because if people believe that our police officers are an occupying force that is not part of this community, that hampers our ability to have better police-community relations. And that obviously happened as a result a change in state law under Governor Walker, where now probably close to half of our police officers don't even reside in the city of Milwaukee. And I think that that's a problem.
Well, and something that we've seen right now, as we've had protesters and activists on the street, they've been frustrated by the Milwaukee Police Department's response to pretty peaceful protests. There was at least one incident of officers firing tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. How are you responding right now to this use of police force?
I made it clear to the police chief, I've made it clear publicly, that I do not think that rubber bullets should be, that they are wrong to be used to disperse crowds. I've said that tear gas should only be used in very, very, very serious situations. Again, not with peaceful protesters. And I shared that with the police chief. And to my knowledge, that has not happened since I shared that with the police chief. You'll have to check with him on that. But there was an incident on roughly 6th and Reservoir, perhaps. And I saw the video of that. And I publicly stated my unhappiness with that, because I think that, have we seen some people who have acted inappropriately? Yes. And we should be mindful that the police officers have a very difficult job. But I think by and large, we have seen very peaceful protests, particularly during the day. We've had some issues at night, and we continue to have issues with reckless driving that has emanated at some of these areas. And that remains a concern. But I think that's more of a local police concern that we see in the summertime. But I think that people have the right, and not I think, I know people have the right under the First Amendment to have peaceful protests, and I support that.
You know, you said you shared these concerns with the police department, but do you have the power to make them stop, using tear gas and rubber bullets?
Well, as you may know, a lot of the Milwaukee is a little bit of an unusual structure in that I am not the boss of the police chief or the police department. We have a citizen board, the Fire and Police Commission, that oversees the police department as well as the fire department. And they're the ones that have rules that they put into place. Again, what I did was I shared my belief with the police chief, and I'm pleased that since I said that, my understanding is we have not had any use of rubber bullets and we have not had any use of tear gas. And I think that's significant. And again, that goes back. Now, it was the Tuesday night after the first weekend where we saw so much activity.
Well, and this gets to a bigger question that I think a lot of us have. Police accountability is something we've been talking about for a long time, but it feels like little has happened there. When we're talking about police accountability, what are the real impediments to getting that kind of accountability? Because it seems like there are always roadblocks.
Well, I looked at what happened in Minneapolis and the defendant in the case in Minneapolis, and I saw that he had something like 18 complaints against him in 18 years. And I thought, oh my God, how does this guy remain on the force? And I honestly don't believe an individual like that would be on the force in Milwaukee. And I'm going to do more work, again, just to review what our complaint procedure is, make sure that we don't allow that to happen. I don't believe, and this is why I've said that I'm going to get a group together that's going to look at our police practices so that I can make sure that I've got the exact information that I need to make recommendations, to work with the Fire and Police Commission, to work with the community group that's been formed in relation to the ACLU lawsuit, so that we have a really solid path forward to deal with issues that are not resolved here in the city of Milwaukee. And that's something that I'm committed to.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm currently speaking with Mayor Tom Barrett. You know, you just mentioned, I believe it was last week, Friday, you announced the creation of a commission called a Commission on Police Accountability and Reform. We've heard from a number of activists who've said that they don't know what this commission is. Just for clarity, was this commission created unilaterally by your administration, or is it the result of collaboration with community members?
I can give you the history of it. I can give you the very short history of it. Last week, when I saw some of the events that occurred, and I started asking questions about them from people in law enforcement, people new law enforcement, I was told that this practice or that practice was something that was approved at the federal level, the state level, the local level. And I thought, well, that might be one of the issues here. Are some of the practices that are well accepted practices, are they practices that we should continue, even if they are approved at the federal level or the state level or the local level? And I thought, I've got to bring together a group that can look into this and give me some good advice. It's not unusual that you'd want to have something like that happen. But the next morning, that was maybe Wednesday, the next morning I woke up and I saw that the mayor of Atlanta sent out a tweet, actually. And in it, she said, "Thank you, President Obama. I accept your challenge. We will form a commission to look at our police practices here in Atlanta." And then I saw Washington, D.C. had done it, and I saw other communities had done it. And I went to the video and saw that President Obama was issuing a challenge to mayors across the nation to look at these practices. And quite honestly, I thought President Obama has the moral force to be a counterweight to the complete lack of leadership we're seeing from President Trump on this. And this gives me an opportunity to do what I had been thinking about doing anyway, and to be doing it hopefully in conjunction with some of the advice I can get on the national level, as well as the local level, as to how we can move our police department forward. So I issued an executive order creating it. And my goal is to complement the work that's been done. There's been a number of community groups and community committees out there. So this is the goal here is to build on the work that they've done and, again, to move the city forward. And I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear that the mayor wants to be engaged in this and lead the effort to improve the police department.
Yeah, I guess one of the questions that we've heard from activists in particular is, you know, Milwaukee already has the Community Collaborative Committee. It also has the Fire and Police Commission. Why create a new group? Why not strengthen the power of either of those existing groups?
Well, I think this goes back to your first question, that there is a sense out there that there hasn't been enough that's been done. I think that was underlying the first part of our conversation is people are frustrated. I can tell you I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated. And I'm just not the type of person who's going to just wring his hands. I think that as the mayor of the city, I think I'm in a unique position to bring all of these groups together. And I think that's an important role for a mayor of any city, not just to bring the groups together. And that's what I'm hoping to accomplish. So again, I see this as adding to what the fine work that has been done, not in any way detracting from any work that anybody has done.
Okay. So, you know, you mentioned a lot of cities are creating these kinds of commissions, committees. A lot of major cities are also looking at defunding the police. Here in Milwaukee, activists are requesting some big budget cuts. Is that something the city is really considering?
Well, again, we've got a unique situation here where last year, I think that the police budget went up, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's about a $300 million budget. And let's just say for the sake of conversation that it went up $4 or $5 million. And again, I don't have the numbers in front of me. That increase of $4 to $5 million translated into a reduction in the number of police officers of 60 police officers. In other words, we had the budget that the council passed had 60 fewer police officers for 2020 than it did for 2019. And as I said at the time, and I'll say it again, that was not a philosophical decision, that was a fiscal decision. We simply did not have the money to maintain the strength of the police department at the level we had in 2019. I would like to tell you that the city coffers are in a better shape this year than last year, but that's not the case. In fact, they're in a much more precarious situation going into the 2021 budget than they were going into the 2020 budget, in large part because of COVID-19, in large part because of our relationship with the state. And so this is a situation where probably no one's going to be happy, because it will be virtually impossible, I think, at this stage for us to maintain the strength of the police department exactly where it is right now. And so when I say unhappy, I think that there's a hope, and I would share this hope. We'd love to be able to put more money into other programs, but we've got some very serious fiscal problems that the city's facing right now. So that's before you even get to the conversation about defunding or anything like that. We've got the real world to deal with right now, which is a huge loss of revenue because of COVID-19, some challenges we have with our pension system, some other challenges that we face. So it's far more complicated than saying fund or defund, because we really know that we've got some serious fiscal challenge.
You know, you said it was a fiscal decision, not a philosophical decision. Are you interested in making that philosophical decision? Because I think that's kind of at the heart of this movement, the desire to make that philosophical decision.
And I think that that's a really important debate to have. And I certainly think that there are some places where we should not have or expect our police officers to do what they're doing. And I'll use as examples the changes we've had in mental health laws over the years. The police have in many ways become the front line workers in our mental health system, basic police services. We know that, and this is the challenge we have, in parts of the city where people feel that the police don't treat them well, and that's a legitimate fear or concern that they have, are also the parts of the city where we get the most calls for service. And so it becomes a very challenging dynamic that if someone is breaking into your home, or if a woman is raped, or if there's reckless driving, who do you call? And I think that's a debate we need to have as a city. That's a debate we need to have as a society. Calls for police for domestic violence is something that happens a lot, and they're considered very dangerous calls for the police to respond to. If we're not going to have police responding to those calls, do we simply as a society not respond to those calls? Who do we send instead to those calls, knowing that they can be very dangerous? But those are all, I think, really important parts of this conversation that we need to have.
You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. And after the state's safer at home order was struck down, the city of Milwaukee still had its own order. But there was a lot of confusion about what that entailed. And throughout this pandemic, there's been a lot of confusion, which I think is in part understandable. But people have expressed frustration with a lack of resources. How has the city been working to clarify safety guidelines for our community?
When you say safety guidelines for communities, are you talking about businesses? Are you talking about individuals?
I think both.
Well, I can tell you just yesterday, I had two webinars, and we had over 250 people at the two webinars talking about the reopening of bars and restaurants and outdoor patios. So people had some guidance as to what to do. I've had conversations with faith leaders about reopening churches. We've had conversations. We had a webinar that was attended by close to 1,000 people about reopening of hair salons and nail salons and barbershops. So I personally have been involved extensively in the outreach to try to help people get the information for the very reason you state, that I think that there's concern and people feeling they don't have the information. It is obviously a fast moving train. And when the Supreme Court decided it was going to weigh in, that, of course, threw everything off track. And Milwaukee felt, and I think it was the right decision, that we would continue to follow the science and we would continue to follow the guidance of the CDC, because the pandemic, as you noted in your initial statement, is still here. And I look at where we are right now, and I look at where we were on Election Day, just for sake of conversation. On Election Day, which was April 7th, here in Milwaukee, we had 1,324 cases, and we had 49 deaths. Yesterday in Milwaukee County, we surpassed 9,000 cases, and we surpassed 300 deaths. So in that period of approximately 2 months, you saw a six-fold increase in the number of cases, and you saw a six-fold increase in the number of deaths, which tells you that we need to continue to take this pandemic very, very seriously.
Yeah. So last week, the city announced, as you mentioned, that restaurants and bars would be able to open. A lot of restaurant owners seemed to be pretty surprised. Some also believed the move was politically motivated to draw attention away from the protests. Can you just give us a timeline for how the city reached the decision to allow restaurants and bars to reopen?
Sure. And I'll tell you, the first Facebook posting that I saw that said that, my reaction was OMG. And the reason for that is, you may be aware that I've been involved in daily briefings for the press for essentially the last 2.5 months. Now they've dropped it to several times a week. But we've talked extensively throughout this period about where we are as a city in relation to the state. I've talked personally extensively about our desire to try to get to a place where we could, under scientific guidance, start opening bars and restaurants. And I underscore following scientific guidance, because I've made it clear, as has our health commissioner, Commissioner Kowalik, that we would follow the science and the public health. And frankly, we're the only community in the state that can continue to do this. At the same time, of course, not surprisingly, I hear from some businesses who say that they don't want to reopen, either practical reasons or they don't think the customers are there. There's some who wanted more leeway, and then there's some that wanted to open immediately. But several weeks ago, and one of the things that we have done is during these weekly briefings or these daily briefings, we've talked about how on Fridays is when the city would make announcements as to whether we would be moving to the next stage. And that's been over the last month, basically, where we've had those conversations. And several weeks ago, we actually were optimistic that we could get to phase three, which is the opening of restaurants. And I stated that publicly. This is all before the civil unrest. And over the course of the weekend, again, this is before the civil unrest, the numbers started going in the wrong direction. And so when we made the announcement that week, we said, unfortunately, our numbers were going in the wrong direction. And so we were not going to be able to go to phase three. But I publicly stated during that press briefing that I was frustrated by that. And that I hoped that in the following week, we would be able to move to phase three. And so that was the weekend actually before the civil unrest. So clearly I had foreshadowed, our health department had foreshadowed that we were getting closer. And once we reached those criteria that allowed us to open, that's when we made the decision to open.
Okay. You know, as we've been talking about, there have been so many transformative things happening to the city of Milwaukee in 2020. It is unbelievably only June. But one thing that we thought would be the most significant thing to happen to the city in a long time, it seems like it's not going to happen, at least not in the same way. The Democratic National Convention. What's going on there? I think there's just a lot of confusion.
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty, and I, for a while there, I was licking my wounds, for lack of a better term, thinking, how can we have all this uncertainty when things are moving so smoothly for the Republicans in their Charlotte convention? Because for months, the word was, there's no problems in Charlotte. There's no problems in Charlotte, and there were concerns, legitimate concerns, that were being raised here, including by myself. About public health and how it was important for us to follow public health. And I always maintain and still maintain that we will have a convention. The Democrats will nominate Joe Biden, and it's going to happen in Milwaukee. Now, beyond that, I don't know that we're going to know exactly what form that is going to be. And we probably still won't know for another 6 or 7 weeks. But it's only in the last couple of weeks when I looked at what's happening with the Republicans in Charlotte and just the announcement in the last 24 hours that they're likely to move a good portion of the convention to Jacksonville, Florida, where I thought, wow, I guess they didn't have their act together. I guess we're in a lot better shape than they are. So as much as we'd like certainty here, I think the one thing we can agree on, everyone can agree on, is that the uncertainty in society this year is unlike any we have seen in a long time.
Yeah. Well, and this might be a difficult question to answer because, as you mentioned, there is a lot of uncertainty. But we've been told this convention would have a huge impact on Milwaukee area businesses, the city's reputation in general. Now that we're looking at, in the best case scenario, a very pared down convention, what do we think that's going to mean for our community?
Well, I think what it's going to mean for our community, and it's not just Milwaukee, it's the nation. Again, we all know with the civil unrest, with the economic turmoil, with the COVID-19 crisis, that communities around this nation are under incredible duress. And I still believe that this is an opportunity for our city to showcase how you come out of a pandemic, how a community deals with police-community relations, how we deal with the economic downturn. And so we've been dealt a hand of cards. And my belief is we play that hand as best we can, because I don't think anybody is expecting, whether it's Milwaukee or Charlotte or Jacksonville, to have the type of convention that people thought was going to happen just 6 months ago. I still think it's an opportunity because the fact remains, this is the first time in the history of the state of Wisconsin that we've been chosen host a major political party convention. And so let's take that opportunity and do the best we can, even under these incredibly trying circumstances.
Yeah. Well, Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your time.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Mayor Tom Barrett has been the mayor of Milwaukee since 2004, and he was just reelected to his fifth term in office earlier this year. He spoke with me through Zoom from his home here in the city. We'll take a short break now, then our Listen MKE series takes a look at police-community relations and what will happen after the protests end. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM is partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. Its goal? Help Milwaukee's Northside residents get the information they want and need. More specifically, we want to better understand what's most important to people who live in these Milwaukee neighborhoods and help fill information gaps. In light of recent protests in Milwaukee and the nation against police violence and systemic racism, the Listen MKE team hosted a Facebook Live event with a community organizer and a local religious leader. They discussed the community's demands for change, police-community relations, and what happens after these protests end. The event was hosted by James Causey, the projects reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. They're joined by Marquesa Tucker, the director of the African American Roundtable, and Pastor Walter Lanier of Progressive Baptist Church. Here's part of that conversation, and Tucker starts by listing protesters' demands.
So some of the demands that we have are specifically for public safety. We know that police do not keep us safe. They are not intervening bodies. They are reactionary bodies. And so we have asked for a $75 million divestment from MPD to reinvest back into building healthy communities that can thrive. And we want $50 million to go back into public health and $25 million into housing cooperatives. Another one of our demands are the rights of protesters be respected and not harmed, and no harm come to them. We know that our mayor, our police chief, along with the county executive, asked Governor Evers to bring the National Guard here. That isn't what keeps people safe. It's a waste of taxpayers' money or whoever's paying for it. It's a waste of their money. And we would prefer to see that protesters who have the right are not tear gassed. They're not hit with rubber bullets. And any of the tickets or the fines that they're receiving in regards to that would be dropped. We are also asking for justice for Joel Acevedo. We know that the officer was charged and has yet to be terminated. And so we stand with the family and ask that the Fire and Police Commission, Chief Morales, whoever's hands it is, to assure this family that he will be fired. And we're also asking for the three named accomplices in the criminal complaint to also be brought to justice. We also are asking the FPC to continue to be the voice of the community. As a civilian body, we want to ensure that that investigation of that officer remains with the FPC and not go back to the police department. We also want to ensure that the accountability to the community would rest with the community, and that Common Council President Cavalier Johnson to immediately appoint members to the Community Collaborative Committee, which did the work around the DOJ recommendations after Dontre's murder. The last two would be around responding to the executive order to bring the National Guard here. So instead of the National Guard coming here, we're asking that housing, that implementation and a moratorium on evictions, foreclosures, rents, mortgage, utility, and disconnections from Milwaukee County residents through the end of 2020 be put in order. We are still in a pandemic. I think people are forgetting because the stay at home are, you know, lifting and people are going out. We're still fighting COVID. The last one is healthcare, a declaration of racism in the state of Wisconsin as a public health crisis. Public and private institutions must be expanded to ensure Milwaukee County residents and have access to affordable health care. We were able to get some of these demands from SJAC, which is St. Joe's Accountability Coalition, that came together when Ascension was looking to really shut down and debunk St. Joe's Hospital.
Yeah, those are quite a bit of demands. Do you believe the mayor and the common council have the fortitude to make the necessary changes to MPD in this new age of policing?
We believe that the power, a lot of this power we know rests with the mayor. We know a lot of this power sits with the chief, but we know also that the Fire and Police Commission is the most powerful governing body in the country. So a lot of this power also resides with them around SOPs, but also the mayor and the common council have a hand in this budget and how this money is going to be invested in or outside of the community. And again, we are also knowing that the Fire and Police Commission and Chief Morales, they have an obligation to answer that call to Joel Acevedo's family about whether or not that officer is going to be terminated. It's one of the two that can do it. They need to figure out who that is and make it happen.
What would you say the role of the church should be in the role of social justice when it comes to this?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So I am a Christian myself and have done my work from that lens. And I appreciate this opportunity for the church to be engaged. You know, there's been tons of missed opportunities, but this is a time now for them to come and humble themselves in the community, and not to just come in and try to plow and bulldoze ideas, but to actually come and listen and be in a space where they can actually hear the work that's been going on, hear the heart of the community and find their place there, but also support those who have already been doing the work like myself or a pastor, Walter Lanier, and find out how we can engage so that we can come together. But this is their absolute role to be doing this work. You know, for anybody who knows anything about Jesus, you know, we want to believe that Jesus, you know, walked around, you know, did miracles, but he also, just like, you know, the analogy that people like to share, the story about him flipping over tables, he was a radical, he was a liberator, and he came to share what needs to be done in order for people to be free. And that is the role of the church.
Right. Pastor, the question for you is, what role should the church play, especially now in the role of social justice?
Well, good afternoon, everybody. And thank you to Marquesa. And she has laid out the case well. I agree that the church should be involved and hopefully would have always been involved even before this time. The church is a body that is supposed to be a voice for justice. One of the challenges for the church, so I won't just talk about progressive, but the church at large, is that traditionally, at least as the way we sometimes hear the narrative, the church was the leader of the civil rights movement, which is not necessarily accurate. They were a part of the community. And so here, the church needs to walk alongside the community. Prayerfully, it's been doing that already, but if not, it does need to do that to hear, as Marquesa has said, what is the heart of the community? What are the demands of the community? How can we amplify the voice of community? How can we speak truth to power? Sometimes our voice will be received differently than those at the grassroots level in the community organizers. And so sometimes we need to raise our voice loudly when we see injustice, a lack of accountability taking place here in the city.
As we talk about the demands and different community organizers coming together and the church being a part of the conversation, how long are you guys prepared to wait? If that's something that you're told by people in leadership positions, is that a conversation that group organizations are having?
Yeah, there is no time for waiting. We're beyond waiting. I think I read this in an article last night with Daryl Gibson from Lit. This is the moment. There is no waiting. There is no taking pauses. We have been asking for these types of things for years and years and years. People have now taken the streets to, I think it's going on 11 or 12 days. The time is now for people to respond to what people in this community want, what taxpayers are paying for. These are our tax dollars, and we deserve today the investment that the people in this city deserve and the people in the city need to live and to thrive. So no, we're not having any questions and conversations around, you know, what the timetable is going to look like. No, we are demanding these things need to be done ASAP.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the protests. You're right. We're going on. We're in the second week of protesting here. And we've we witnessed the good of the protests. We've seen a lot of peaceful marches. We've also seen some looting and some buildings burn. But for the most part, it's been great. But this past weekend, we also saw the ugly when an attorney spit in the face of a Black Lives Matter protester, a young teen. Can you talk a little bit about that incident and what you saw?
First thing I thought was, this is what has been hiding behind corners on neighborhood blocks, in our classrooms with our students, in the workplaces that we're in, grocery stores. These are the people that we live amongst. And they are starting to come out more and more. And how disgusting, I mean, disgusting on all levels, disgusting, you know, physically, mentally, all of those things, that someone could spit in anyone's face, let alone a young person who is out just simply utilizing his right to protest. It's absolutely disgusting. And I'm glad that those folks on the ground, like Shavonda from Love on Black Women, continue to press until we made sure that what I heard was a phony first arrest actually turned into a real arrest. And that this woman is sitting in jail, if she is or not, I'm not sure, but that she also needs to lose her law license, like easily. No one should want her to practice law anywhere. She's a disgusting individual and she has a lot that she needs to think about her own personal self. But that is what the root of white supremacy looks like. It will spit in the face of a person who has the right to be out peacefully protesting.
What happens after the protest? What's next?
Absolutely. Well, right now, I don't think these protests are going to stop until some of these demands are met. So right now it's what can happen after the protest, which is continually developing leaders, teaching people how to organize. We are doing an amazing job in Milwaukee with Frank and Frank Nitti and Khalil, really leading and mobilizing people to the streets, which is an important part of the movement work to keep the energy going and to keep our face and our messages in front of people until we get what we want. And I'm hearing that they're ready to stay in those streets until we get what we want. And I know that includes getting the officer who killed Joel Acevedo, get him fired, you know, getting the divestment from the police department. And I know the budget goes throughout the year. So I don't know. These people are ready to stand, though, in the streets until they get what they want. You know, we're going to be organizing around a city budget that is already really started. We'll be actually relaunching Liberate MKE all next week, doing virtual learnings and education. So if folks are interested in that, they should definitely follow our page. But we want to educate people. We want to do trainings and workshops for folks who want to learn lobbying, how to effectively tell your story, how to draft an email to an elected official, but also giving them opportunities to get engaged in the process by sharing actions and, again, developing leaders.
Now, have you seen a police department do divesting the right way? Has that worked successfully in other cities that you could point to and say, you know, San Francisco did this, so Milwaukee could copy that plan and divest from the police department and put that funding into community groups? Have you seen that done effectively anywhere?
I'm not sure. I think Reggie Moore from the Office of Violence Prevention may have shared maybe something that was maybe in Oakland or California where they did do that and they invested more into violence prevention and it worked. I know that the conversation now for some people across the country, though, is moving more towards defunding versus divestment. And that's a conversation we need to have with folks here in the community for folks to really understand why those conversations are shifting and why we want to ensure that people, as we, you know, share new terms and new messages, that they know why we're saying it, but also the importance of why it's going to help to keep our people safe. So that stuff that we, our organizer, Devin Anderson, he does a lot of the research around policies and what's happening in other places. But of course, he's busy working today, so I don't have all the details right in front of me.
But if you can try to help help us understand what that divest, when you take money from the police department and you put it into programs, how does crime go down, and how does that improve community and neighborhoods and things like that? Can you walk us through that process of how you envision this working?
Absolutely. So when we started Liberate MKE, we partnered with Black Leaders Organizing with Communities, or for communities. And the one thing that I know Black had been doing since August of 2017, when they hit the ground, knocking on doors daily up until just COVID hit, was having conversations with people. What would it look like for you to thrive? Just a really simple question. And people said stuff like, oh, you know, access to, you know, food, you know, clean water, access to transportation so we can get to jobs, quality education. You know, people know that when they have the things that they need, their basic needs met, we can reverse tons of things. Because guess what we're doing? We're actually preventing some things from happening, because people are going to have jobs, because people are going to have access to food, and people are going to have access to transportation to get to their jobs. So we're talking about, what does prevention look like? And investing in prevention is a way better investment than doing something that doesn't. And there's been reports done. Policing doesn't necessarily in crime. It doesn't slow crime. It doesn't wrap crime. So if we already have the reports out there, we have the messaging, and we know that prevention actually works, then what are we waiting for to put resources and money to what we know works? We also, during the Liberate MKE campaign, when we sat down and talked to people in the community, we said, draw a picture about that shows what it would look like to have like a thriving neighborhood. And not one of the pictures did anybody draw the police in regards to what a safe and thriving community looked like.
That's impressive.
It's a,
Go ahead.
Marquesa, since we're you know, talking about the specifics of, you know, what divestment and the police will look like, I want to ask you about another term that I've just been seeing like circulating, and that's police abolishing the police. I know that hasn't been anything that you've spoken on specifically, but is there any kind of insight that you could give into what that would look like?
So first, with, you know, like I said, the conversation have gone from divestment to just completely defunding it, because what we know that policing is rooted in is in slavery, and we know that it's violent, we know that it's oppressive, and it hasn't worked. It has not worked. It's killing people, and people need to start thinking about, what does real safety look like? It looks like what we've been talking about, investing in people and putting the power in their hands. Like I see Nate's comment right now, putting the power into the people's hands and allowing them to do the work that they know looks best for them. We need to, when we say defund, we're talking about, we need a whole new system. We need a whole new creation of what it looks like for people to look to be safe, but it can't be something that's rooted in what our police departments are rooted in, that culture that people talk about. The culture is because it came from slavery, period. End of the story. You can't change that. You can't lie about it. You can try to cover it up, but that's the truth. Policing is rooted and came from slavery, and we know that needed to be abolished. And so does policing.
I kind of want to that leads me into this next question as far as groups that are working to make change. Someone asks, there has been an announcement about forming a commission for police reform. Has Liberate MKE been contacted or affiliated with this sentiment? And then I have a question to add to that. Do you think another commission is necessary?
This is a great question. I'm so glad that you asked. So the committee that I was a part of last year, the Community Collaborative Committee, that came from the DOJ coming to town after Dontre Hamilton was murdered by a former police officer. And so that committee was really the voice of the community. What does the community want? And the community said, you know, we want reform. We want, you know, community relations. And because I was asked to be a part of that work and to help the community, I took on that responsibility as the chair. We developed a report, and these are the things that people said they wanted. That report is available, and we've shared it with the community. We've done share outs. And so now where does that leave that committee? This committee was actually a part of the ACLU settlement and has been established to stay as the Community Collaborative Committee, as kind of like a accountability board, like a baby, honestly, accountability board to the FPC to ensure what the community did say they wanted actually gets pushed and moved forward. So what happened just a few days ago or last week when the mayor announced a new committee, commission, or a task force? We're very confused what that committee would do when there's already a committee with community members who will be assigned to the committee already. We're just waiting, as a part of my demand, that Chevy appoints people, the mayor gets an appointment, the roundtable gets an appointment, and a bunch of other communities groups. So we're not sure what's happening, but it's very confusing to the community for the mayor to start another committee when there's already another committee. I'm not for any more committees. We're over committees. We just want our demands met at this point.
That was Marquesa Tucker of the African American Roundtable and Pastor Walter Lanier of Progressive Baptist Church. They spoke with Listen MKE hosts WUWM's Taryn Powell and the Journal Sentinel's James Causey. The mayor did address that question about the new committee in our conversation with him, and you can hear that at WUWM.com. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. The full conversation will air tonight on Channel 10 at 7:30 p.m., and you can also find it at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Julian Haida join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Taryn Powell, Susan Bentz, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.